Several weeks ago, I mentioned that I would be preaching sermons throughout the summer that I hope to be able to revise and include in a book I'm writing, a book on what it means to be a thoughtful Christian. When I made that plan to do that, I wasn't really thinking forward well enough because this also is the summer when the General Assembly meets. It meets every other year. The General Assembly is the highest governing body of our denomination, and whenever the General Assembly meets, they enact legislation or take actions which require a certain amount of interpretation from the pulpit. And so I have been trying to find ways to blend book writing and General Assembly interpretation, and I'm doing that again this morning. 2 weeks ago, I did this when I talked about the fact that the General Assembly made it possible for Presbyterian ministers to officiate at the weddings of same-sex marriages, same-sex couples. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about our denomination's decision to divest from three companies, Motorola, Hewlett-Packard, and Caterpillar, which are profiting from violence and occupation in Israel-Palestine. It's an interesting day for me to talk about this because exactly 4 years ago today, I was in Jerusalem. I was interviewing the Muslim man whose family for centuries has kept peace at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That building, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, is Christianity's holiest shrine. And at least four Christian denominations claim it as their own, and they occupy some part of it. And the only reason Christians don't kill each other over competing claims to the place of Jesus' crucifixion and burial is that a Muslim family has opened the door each morning and locked it each night for at least since the end of the Third Crusade. It is a story that I find fascinating, and I wanted to write about it, so I went to interview the current doorkeeper. I was in the Holy Land to ask questions. But in many ways, for me, the trip was defined by a question that the customs official asked me at the very beginning of my stay in Israel-Palestine. And here's the question that she asked me. Why are you going to France? I was confused by that question. Admittedly, it had been a long journey from San Jose to Tel Aviv by way of Los Angeles and Atlanta. And the customs officials at Ben Gurion Airport in Israel are notorious interrogators. So a certain measure of befuddlement on my part was to be expected. But who needs a reason to go to France? I explained my itinerary. I was on my way to visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. After a few days in Israel, I would travel to Cordoba in Spain by way of the south of France. I was writing a book on the relationship between Christianity and Islam, and my itinerary, though admittedly erratic, was entirely consistent with the research I wanted to do for my book, which isn't exactly true, actually. Jerusalem and Cordoba, both are cities rich in the history of encounters between Islam and Christianity. The south of France was sort of a stretch book-wise, but there it was. Right on the way from Judea to Andalusia, waiting for me to stop in for a visit. So I decided to go to France, just for a couple of days. My interlocutor, the woman who stood holding my passport between me and the city of God, dropped her eyes to half-mast and asked me if I was married. When she heard that I was, she clenched her jaw and she glared at me. "You go to France," she said. "And how come you're not bringing your wife?" She sent me to her superior for further interrogation and inspection. The superior marked my passport, and as a result, I was subjected to interrogation and inspection everywhere I went. While visiting places I learned about in Sunday school, I got strangely accustomed to watching as young women bedecked with lethal weapons poked around in my luggage and sometimes sent the most private bits of my used laundry down into the sacred dust of the Holy Land. "It's for your own good," these women told me each time I bent down to retrieve a pair of boxer shorts. This is how we find terrorists. During my visit to Israel, I expected to encounter harsh security because I am a progressive Protestant pastor who believes Palestinians suffer undue affliction under Israel's policies of occupation and settlement. I did not, however, expect to endure the psychological trials of extended questioning, nor the indignity of frequent and complete searches of my luggage, because I am the kind of unromantic, chowder-headed cad who goes to France without his wife. So 3 weeks ago, after 10 years of deliberation on the subject, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA voted to divest from three publicly traded U.S.-owned multinational corporations which profit from the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. And when I heard the news, I thought immediately about how I was treated in Israel based on something I wasn't doing in France with my wife who was in California. Though my trip to the Holy Land was intentionally non-political, while in Israel, I couldn't avoid politics. Israeli security is what it is because of politics. When I interviewed the keeper of the doors of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, we met in his house, which has been in the family for untold generations, and which is starting to get dilapidated but could not be repaired because, thanks to politics, Arab Israelis seldom get building permits to fix their houses. When I went to Bethlehem, I crossed through a wall which, in the name of security and in response to political realities, the government of Israel has built deep into Palestinian territory, such that it divides families and communities, separates farmers from their land, and puts control of Palestinian water supplies entirely in the hands of Israel. Because of the politics, when I rode Israeli buses from Jerusalem to the Sea of Galilee, I could not find a seat that was not next to someone carrying an assault rifle. In a similar way, just as I tried to avoid politics in Israel, I've been trying to avoid talking about Israel-Palestine from the pulpit for many years. I used to talk and write about the Holy Land quite a lot, but I got really tired of it. In 2004, when the General Assembly first started talking about divesting from companies that profit from the violence in Israel-Palestine, I got really involved. I initiated a Jewish Presbyterian dialogue to talk through our differences on the issues that surround the conflict in the Holy Land. I went to San Francisco and spoke directly to the board of the Anti-Defamation League about the Presbyterian process of divestment from companies that profit from the occupation. But the net result of all that dialogue and discussion was that time and time again, Jewish and Christian supporters of Israel called me an anti-Semite when I expressed my concern for the well-being of Palestinians. And I got old. My skin just wasn't thick enough, and it's still not. And yet the Presbyterian Church has completed the process of divesting from Caterpillar, Motorola, and Hewlett-Packard, and I still support the use of such economic leverage to effect change. And so the issue seems worthy of comment from the pulpit, but I'll be honest with you. Back in the day when I was talking about Israel-Palestine a lot, by far the worst personal attacks came not from Jewish supporters of Israel, but from progressive Presbyterians, who for years have been nurturing interfaith relationships and were worried about the ongoing health of those relationships. And I realize that here I am in a room surrounded by progressive Presbyterians who have a long history of engaging in interfaith dialogue. Now, I know that a lot of people in this congregation share my concerns about the well-being of Palestinians, but I also know that some of you will not agree with me, and I want to say that's okay. If I get you to think twice and prayerfully about your convictions, even if you don't agree with me, I've done my pastoral duty. And as always, I invite you to talk with me. Just speak tenderly with me when you disagree with me. My support for the Presbyterian divestment from Caterpillar, Motorola, and HP is based in two convictions. First, I don't believe the Presbyterian Church should profit from violence of any kind. And personally, I don't want my pension invested in companies that profit from violence of any kind. In the last couple of weeks, three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped and killed, presumably by Palestinian terrorists. In response, the Israeli army detained more than 500 Palestinians without due process. They killed 15 Palestinians, including two children and one mentally ill adult. The entire population of the city of Hebron, all 68,000 of them, was put on lockdown as a form of collective punishment in contradiction to international law. And you know what? I don't want part of any of it. In 2004, when the Presbyterian Church first decided to engage in the process of that ultimately led to the divestment from Caterpillar, Motorola, and Hewlett-Packard, our denomination started by looking at five companies, two of which ultimately were determined not to be profiting from the violence. And one of those companies was a bank that was suspected of laundering money for Palestinian terrorists. That bank happened to own the mortgage on my house. So, at the cost of thousands of dollars, Ann and I refinanced our mortgage. We didn't want to be connected to Palestinian violence any more than we wanted to be connected to Israeli violence. It's all bad. I want to grieve with Israeli families who lose loved ones due to Palestinian violence. And I want to support the efforts of Palestinians who work peacefully to be free from Israeli occupation. And that leads me to the second reason I support divestment. Divestment is a nonviolent response to an extremely violent situation. The Israeli occupation of Palestine is sucking the life out of both nations, and it is having a detrimental effect on countries in the region and across the world as well. The last thing we need in the Holy Land is more violence, more weapons, or more logistical support for violence on either side. Divestment is an effective way to work towards an end without killing anyone. And I like that. There are those who say that divestment is ineffective. And in response to that, I would point out that when the Presbyterian General Assembly divested from these three companies, the Israeli Prime Minister went on Meet the Press to excoriate our denomination. And right there is proof that divestment is an effective nonviolent tool for change. If it wasn't making a difference, no Prime Minister would pay attention. It works, and I like things that work. But of course, all this discussion about divestment leads to a larger question, and that is, should Christian churches even be involved in politics in the first place? When the Presbyterian Church does things like divest from companies that profit from Israel's occupation in Palestinian land, or when we speak out on behalf of immigrants, or when we work on issues like climate change or marriage equality, inevitably someone will say, but Christians shouldn't be involved in politics at all. They say that there's a separation between church and state, which means that we should go about the work of saving souls, and dispensing charity is fine so long as we stick to feeding people and don't ask why they are hungry in the first place, and so long as we don't do anything to change the societal structures that keep people poor. And it's tempting to agree with those who want politics kept out of pulpits. After all, who wants to be like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, or those kooks from Kansas who show up with homophobic signs every time a high school performs the Laramie Project? Who wants to get dressed for church on a Sunday morning only to be subjected to a political rant with which you disagree? And who wants to subject others to the bits of our political doctrines that might cause offense, even when they're entirely righteous? It's a tempting, tempting thing to say we should keep politics out of religion. But keep in mind, if we were to expunge all politics from the churches, we wouldn't just be getting rid of the religious right. We'd also be getting rid of Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day and Desmond Tutu and Jim Wallace and William Sloan Coffin and Pope Francis. Over the centuries, people of faith have played instrumental roles in ending slavery and in winning the right of women to vote, in overcoming Jim Crow, and even in making marriage equality a reality in so many states, all because we have allowed politics to creep into our churches. People of faith have spoken out against wars in Vietnam and in Iraq. We opposed American sponsored violence in Central America, and now we are speaking out in support of Palestinian rights, or some of us are. And if you disagree, please don't disengage. Go buy stock in Caterpillar. Buy a Motorola phone and an HP printer. Donate money to the Anti-Defamation League, which actively is trying to change Presbyterian policy. Follow your heart prayerfully and thoughtfully. But just remember this. The Spirit's call also has gone out to those of us who feel we must act on our desire to see Palestinians living in peace out from under Israeli domination. The Spirit calls us and we respond in different ways. May that realization inspire a certain amount of forbearance and charity among us all. I've never known the Spirit to call us to a selective faith. There is no part of life that is exempt from the demands of righteousness and justice and mercy and grace. That means that for people of faith, politics are as unavoidable in the United States as they are in the Holy Land, and it means that we must speak out and be active and work for change even when we'd rather stand on the sidelines singing kumbaya. It's inconvenient, Because inaction always has been easier than conflict. But if we pay attention to the Bible, to passages like the one that was read before I started preaching, if we pay attention, we will realize that when we speak out on political issues, we are practicing a biblical faith, an ancient faith, a faith that is attentive to the best traditions in Christian history. You see, as I study history, I am most proud to call myself a Christian. When I hear stories of men and women of faith who have taken action, who have spoken out on controversial issues, and who have given of themselves to change the world even when the cost was great. And I want to believe that the best days of the Christian church lie in the future. And those best days will come when Christians rise up en masse to make our society more caring, more just, more peaceful. When our influence at home will help keep children healthy and well-educated and well-fed, and when our activism overseas will play a part in doing things like establishing a just peace in the Holy Land. If we're going to get there, we will have to push and pull and stretch in ways that will be uncomfortable. And sometimes we will push and pull and stretch in directions that are diametrically opposed to each other. But I trust the Spirit to lead us safely on, to use us and to inspire us to do great things, and to bring us at last into the beloved community we all long to see made manifest on earth. Amen.